And of course, George, you're our special guest this hour. We're going to take phone calls, questions for George, or your thoughts about trends for 2016. You've heard some of the things we've been talking about. Jump on board. Welcome back to Coast, George. You're with us. We'll get to your calls too. George, tell me about Rural Pioneer. What's going on there?
Well, I've decided that this is the year to put a little more effort into Rural Pioneer. A friend of mine who is an oil rig engineer. And yes, there are still oil rigs out
there. Yeah, there are many, as a matter of fact.
And when oil goes back up, which is one of those left field possibilities, things will be cooking in Houston again, although they're not right now. But Rural Pioneer started, gosh, a long time ago. I was looking for a little different voice than Urban Survival. Urban Survival was my capstone project in my MBA program back in the mid-90s. And the problem with Urban Survival is I did not trademark it. And so if you do a Google search on the words urban and survival, you'll get something like 7 million hits on it.
Wow.
And it really was, you know, it was a lot of fun. And between that and peoplenomics.com website, I feel like we actually had a major contribution to the starting of the prepper movement back in the 2000-2002 period when I was living on a sailboat, and we really were ready to sail around the world at one point. But Rural Pioneer is a little different. Rural Pioneer I actually did trademark, and that website is about being a modern subversive in a nice legal way. And what I mean by a modern subversive, somebody who actually tries to do a little bit of recycle, repurpose, reuse, a place where we can talk about the things that really tick us off. I don't like to buy things twice. And one of the problems we have in America is that there are certain items that you almost have to buy every 6 months, every year, every 2 years, 5 years. Things like plastic gas cans. Oil Man 2 is his moniker because he doesn't want to use his real name in public. But he wrote a devastating piece, and we've been complaining about how bad plastics are. You know, plastics are everywhere, and they're not really the right product for things like consumables. Almost every country in the world uses glass because it's cleaner, it doesn't have parting compound, it doesn't break down in the sun, it doesn't float around the Pacific, you know, all of those things. And yet there really are either extremes of environmentalism or there are extremes of plasticism. And what Rural Pioneer is about is trying to find the rational way to recycle, repurpose, reuse, and make a life that is not in the box we're being put into. There's a major downsizing of America. Remember, we were talking earlier about the migration mm-hmm. into virtual space.
Sure.
Part and parcel of that is new housing is coming online that is designed around the concept of 350 square feet per person, and people are expected to use that square footage to live most of their life in, except when they go to public places. Well, there's a different way you can live. You can find inexpensive rural property. You can put a little cabin on it. You can have, you know, some basic gardening, some basic survival goods, and lower property taxes because you get taxed on the improvements on property as much as anything else. And in fact, just to give you an idea of comparison, a friend of mine up in Seattle, the Seattle area this year, he and his wife are paying almost $3,000 of property tax, and that's nothing. I mean, $7,000, $8,000, even $10,000, $12,000 is not uncommon in Southern California. And yet out here in what I call the Outback, our total tax bill this year on 29 acres was $887 or so. So there are different ways to live. And we don't honor thrift like we used to in America. When you and I were young, what were our grandparents talking about?
In our day?
Yeah, in the day.
Oh, gosh, everything.
I mean, it was saving stamps. It was, you know, building your own, you know.
Paying things off. They liked doing it with cash.
Yeah, you live the cash lifestyle. You buy quality. And if something breaks, what did your grandpa do?
He fixed it.
Exactly. Well, you know, that's the kind of thing that we don't hear about too much on the prepping websites. We don't hear about American inventiveness. I have a really nice riding lawnmower, and it's got a 23 horsepower V-twin engine on it. And a couple of years ago, the starter gear broke, so I tore it apart to fix it. And it was plastic. And I called the manufacturer and I said, "What the hell are you doing? Why are you using plastic starter gear?" And I got 15 minutes of runaround. When the fact of the matter is, you know, starting gears on cars are virtually all metal because plastic just doesn't cut it. But these guys in the small engines world have made a fortune for themselves selling $20 replacement gears every 3 years. Once your engine, you know, starts 500 times, there you go. You got to buy something. So, you know, I take a certain amount of pride in flying a 50-year-old airplane, driving a 15-year-old truck and a 10-year-old car.
All right, George, let's take calls for you because they're lining up, my friend. Let's go to Tom in Riverside, California. Tom, you're up with us.
Yeah, I'd like to ask your guest, George, thing that bothers me, you know, one of the things you said was the migration into this country, or the what I look at is some sort of program of forced immigration, not forced, they're being forced, but it's being forced upon the American people, and we're losing our identity, really, I feel that, over the last 35, 40 years, and all this is being forced. You can see it, you know, we're being forced to accept these people into this country, and what about the other people that are standing on the street corners? Why aren't they being given a job? I would think that if you were in charge of anything, you would want to be creating, reviving Detroit, reviving our industries, and seeing that vocational programs are in the high schools, and that we can get our act together, not bringing people in. And where do these people, I can't get enough money to get out of this country. Where are these people coming from war-torn countries? And El Salvador, Honduras, the Middle East, and Africa, where are they getting the money to buy houses and buy cars? I just throw that out there, and I'll take your...
Okay. What do you think, George? You know, he's right. I have always been baffled how people from some of these poverty-stricken nations, and you know, I feel sorry for all of them, but I mean, how do they buy things here so quickly?
Because they have a very high level of incentive, and we don't have that same entrepreneurial core because it's been largely bred out of us in our public education system that we need to go to work for somebody else rather than becoming responsible for starting our own business to generate local products. Don't get me wrong on the immigration thing. I have written rant after rant after rant on urban survival, and also I've looked at the economics of it over on the Peoplenomics side. I don't like it. It is not what we sent people to Washington to do. We did not send them to bring in foreign people who many of whom may not even like us. But the fact of the matter is that in the very short term, immigration is an economic boom. The people need houses, they need cars, they need social services. There are reason to raise taxes. There are reason for more government. At some level, even the gangs coming in from South America represent a tremendous opportunity for the American for-profit prison system. Now, I don't think we should have... That's true!
Come on, if you catch them...
Well, yeah, and you know how you don't catch them, so you perpetuate the problem? You announce your raids a month in advance. And we just did that. I mean, we've been hearing about big sweep coming, and guess what? The sweep came, and it's like, everybody knew it was coming, so everybody who was really, you know, worth going after relocated as soon as they heard that was coming down. And so we're playing this, gosh, I don't want to borrow my friend Howard's term, American Kabuki theater, but kind of like that. I mean, it's a charade. We have elections, but we don't have any means of enforcing politicians to hold to their word once they take office. Essentially what happens is, yeah, we can elect somebody from here in Texas, but as soon as they go back to Washington, in come the lobbyists, in come the checks, in comes the fundraising, here comes the dark money from Connecticut, from Delaware, from, you know, all these other states. The biggest problem, the quickest way to clean up America would be to outlaw any campaign financial contribution, cash or in kind, from outside of the district where the election is taking place. In other words, if you can't vote in the election, you can't finance it. Now, that's a real simple one, but both political parties have gotten so tight with major corporations, they don't have the cojones to stand up to the paymasters and say, no, we're going to be responsible to the base.
Well, let me tell you. You know that song from Twisted Sister, "We're Not Going to Take It"?
Yeah, but we do.
People feel that way right now.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not right, George, but nobody has ever gone after the Federal Trade Commission for failing to enforce truth in advertising. I can give you any politician holding either congressional or Senate or presidential office, and I can put a very convincing case together based on their campaign advertising, and there's probably not one of them that would get out without some kind of punitive action if the Federal Trade Commission had the backbone, the spine, to really defend American interests, which is, if you say you're going to do it, you by God got to do it. Remember, in broadcasting, to go back into how this kind of thinking works, in the 1970s, I was really deeply involved in how responsive the broadcasting community was in Seattle, and we had something called the Community Ascertainment Group. Broadcasters are licensed by the federal government, and they have to periodically, every year, do a report on how their programming is responsive to the needs of the community. And so we had to go out and talk to people and actually respond in public service, public affairs programming, news coverage of topics, and so forth. We don't have an analog to that in politics. We elect people to office, they come in as poor do-gooders, and they go to Washington and come back rich, non-responsive types, and it's not right.
No, not at all. John in Sebring, Florida. John, welcome to the program.
Privileged to be on with two Georges right now. I enjoy both of you so much. I just learned tonight about the website you have, George Peoplenomics. I'll be hitting that.
Good.
And, of course, my question is going to refer to two Georges. And I want to refer back to my favorite George, Washington, fighting that King of England, George. History of our USA. Now, George here with Peoplenomics, trends. Earlier in the show, you said one problem Jeb has is the Bush name and the two Georges who were presidents. I would like you to say to us, in your opinion, you said that they're a problem for him. What is it, those two Georges, what as presidents, what did they do so wrong?
Well, in my opinion, before we got into the position where we started getting addicted to migration as a growth industry, we got into the business of making lots of money in the arms industry. There were not, to the best of my knowledge, weapons of mass destruction. I think we got into Iraq on questionable pretext. I think that the way Congress has been systematically ignored in terms of war-making powers from Clinton, well, going all the way back to Vietnam on, we have been ignoring the right role of Congress in the promotion and funding of wars. I don't think that, going back to what I said about lobbyists, I don't believe the Bushes were any more immune to the effects of the Washington law firms and lobbyists than was the Clinton administration or the Obama administration. From a policy standpoint, they're virtually identical, except in the window dressing.
Explain.
Well, take something like U.S. Middle East policy. The background of U.S. Middle East policy was that the Clinton administration was running a somewhat balanced approach to things like the Palestinian problem, as it was called at the time. And along came the Project for a New American Century, and the notion of regime change started making the rounds. And this was adopted and was taken up as the right way to sort things out in the Middle East. We started attempting to change government. And so far, our success record in effecting regime change has been that where we've gone in and actually done it, we haven't really reaped any particular benefit. And in fact, we have caused some of our own problems of today. Even the Obama administration's policies with Libya, for one example, have yet to yield any net positive effect that I can see.
Next up, Tom in Concord, California. Tom, let's, well, I tell you what, we're coming up on a break, so and I don't want to put you on hold, so we will wait a little bit on that. And George, give us your websites, if you could, real quickly.
Well, let's see. There's, for going rural, there's ruralpioneer.com. The big one that's free is urbansurvival.com. The one that looks at markets and more of the economic trends is peoplenomics.com.
Okay, very good. And by the way, folks, if you would, we're looking for more of you Coast Insiders who have been using the program for a while to simply send me an email, because we want you to be part of our promotional team. George at coasttocoastam.com. Include, you, if you would, your phone number in that as well. George at coasttocoastam.com. We're going to come back in just a moment with George Ure and take your final questions and your thoughts on trends in 2016 right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, and welcome back to Coast. George Ure with us. Your final phone calls as well. Fast night, George, huh?
Oh, they go really fast, George. I enjoy chatting with you.
So this wacko in North Korea, I mean, there's some question. They haven't verified this hydrogen bomb underground test yet, but he probably did it. He was boasting a few days ago that they had one. Is this guy that dangerous, or is he just insane?
Oh, gosh. Can I take a little from column A and a little from column B? right now, by the way, the U.S. Stock futures are down a little bit. Dow looks like it's going to open down about 100 tomorrow morning. And that will change about an hour before the open because the ADP jobs numbers will come out.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we're in this period where my cycles and my view of the markets has been suggesting that we would have a letdown sometime between the 1st of December and the 1st of February, and that would back the markets way down. And we had the first shoe of that drop on the China decline Monday. So this should finish up this move down as the guy in North Korea, the fear about Korea works through the marketplace. Whether he's nuts, I think anybody who builds atomic weapons has to be looked at as a little suspect. You know, it's not exactly the warm, friendly, fuzzy kind of relationship builder that I like. But on the other hand, when you've been raised in a culture of paranoia and everybody in the country is oriented toward hating the West over a long enough period of time, this is what we get. And it's really, I hate to say it, but it's great for the world's defense industries. Because
it's huge for them.
Yeah,
huge.
And see, that's what people forget when they read news stories. They don't sit back and go, well, if this guy lights off an H-bomb, what does that really mean? Well, there was an article, speaking of the U.S. lack of success in regime change, there was an article in Air Force Magazine Monday about how we're out of bombs. Not entirely, but getting very close and to the point of rationing. So, you know, the war on ISIS, is really turning into a major cash cow. We don't have an incentive to quickly end wars via strategic moves because they are what is keeping the global economy alive. The problem with democracy and capitalism as we have built it in America is we absolutely depend on having continuous growth. And without growth of some kind, inevitably we have a collapse of debt, and that takes with it a collapse of savings. And so in order to maintain the wealth of the people, I hate to say it, but we got to have growth. And in order to have growth, where do you get it? Do you get it from migration? Do you get it from environmental wars? I mean, that's really what the global warming issue is. It's not really so much about global warming. It's about extending government control and coming up with a new environment tax at a global level. And that, in turn, can be funneled by the megalomaniacs at the top into the world government. So it all really fits together. It's not a big mystery. But when people read singular headlines, they don't sit back and go, well, let's see, if this happens, then this has to happen. And if that happens, then we'll have to bump up our troop levels in South Korea. And if we bump up our troop levels in South Korea, what does that do to our ongoing presence? We're looking at a semi-permanent force in Afghanistan. And what does that do to our force commitments in places like NATO and in the Middle East? So there's a huge ripple on effect. And as I said before, the real left field possibility is that North Korea with an H-bomb will partner up with somebody in the Middle East, and now we've really
got our
hands full.
That's right. Let's go to Tom at Concord, California now.
Yeah, Tom.
Go ahead, Tom.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I was just concerned on what your thought would be about the seemingly emergence of what I call megacities, and I live in the San Francisco Silicon Valley area, which seemingly has an economic environment which exists along with other international cities such as London or Beijing or such things. I'm in a old working class neighborhood, and the house next to me, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, just sold for $950,000.
Wow.
And it seems that certain cities, San Francisco, Bay Area, Silicon Valley, attracts the best and the brightest. The median house in the city or condo is $1.2 million, and a lot of it's internationalized. And what kind of a future is that going to portend for what we knew as America and old Rust Belt cities? And are we becoming just a world of huge economic cities like London, Beijing, San Francisco, Dubai, or things like that? And where do you think that's going to head?
Well, there's a long answer. There is a very good series of books written by a University of Washington retired professor emeritus of economics by the name of Dr. Jack Lessinger. Lessinger wrote a book that I read, and I've talked to Jack several times. He wrote a book called Pinturbia years ago, and then a book that dealt with the ex-urban phenomenon. That's one of the reasons that we're still out here in the outback of East Texas, because it's one of the few places that is still relatively inexpensive, and it's a big day when we see five cars on the 13-mile drive into town. And this is from me, and I used to drive the 480 Grand Prix from San Jose up to Oyster Point Moreno when we lived on our boat in San Francisco. The problem is that there are certain industries which tend to congregate. Cupertino, San Jose, that whole area is the software, hardware kind of center of the universe. Los Angeles is another big one, Strip City. For some insights into what the government has in mind, look up Agenda 21. Agenda 21 is a scheme or plan of the United Nations et al., and it's designed to preserve wildlands in America. Ultimately, what you can envision, if we keep creeping toward that 10 billion population mark, is you can envision a world where you get out of a strip city and then you're on the front door of Yellowstone. it'll be that sharp a contrast. A few of us think that holding small family farm-sized pieces of property is a really good plan to ensure family wealth in the long term. But not everybody agrees with that. And certainly, if you can get founder stock in a high-tech company, that's going to outperform rural real estate. But for the little guys, rural real estate is probably where to be. In the very short term, I think we still have one more leg up in the market. I take this as being the last leg up before a big depression. And yeah, we're selling our airplane this year for that reason. And it's not a real fancy airplane. But we're looking at structuring our personal income and expense so that no matter what happens, we're always cash flow positive. The other thing that you have to consider, in addition to the strip city and where you're going to live and how much is it going to cost to get around and what are oil prices going to do in that whole stew, you also need to crank in what the future of Social Security is. For those of us, I'm 67 right. In a month.
So you're drawing. You're drawing now, I guess,
oh,
right?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And believe me, it's not a bad thing. The problem is that those of us who are drawing now will probably, because old people vote a lot, will probably get to keep our benefits, but younger people coming up will have their benefits dialed back, which
yeah.
means that it's even more important than ever to start looking at things like owning real estate, not renting to make somebody else rich, and developing some self-sufficiency.
Wasn't there a time that Social Security was flush with cash?
Yeah, absolutely. The 50s under Eisenhower. But what has happened is, again, politicians are big on the free lunches, and at some point they end up breaking the piggy bank, whether it's the National Highway Trust Fund or whether it's the Social Security, quote, trust fund. And basically the government borrows money from itself and does interagency IOUs for the funding. You know who's the real expert on this, and you have her on frequently, is Catherine Austin.
Oh, she's great.
Yeah, she's great. And her website is Solari.com, which is another really good website for a rational, you know, not a panic or doom porn kind of view. It's just, you know, more of this try to read a news story and then figure how think of it as every news story is a gear, and it moves all the other news stories that are connected to it around a little bit.
Let's go to Mayat in New York City. Hello, Mayat.
Yes, good morning, George.
Morning.
I've been wanting to join the Insider, so I'll be sending my email with my phone number.
Okay.
I do a project called 21PR Angel, but George, we love you. And I have a two-part question, and I'll listen over the air. First, I'd like to hear more, especially for the newer listeners, of your methods of looking at trends. And the main part of my concern, though, is those of us who explore what Peter Dale Scott called deep politics, meaning that nothing, as the Eastern philosophies say, is all Maya, nothing is what it seems. Those of us who look to, say, Trine, T-R-I-N-E, day publishers, and pick up the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as Mass Ritual, and Peter Lavender's trilogy, Sinister Forces, Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. In other words, there's, and I guess the question is around consciousness, because it seems that there's no question we're heading toward totalitarianism, as you said, Agenda 21, the New World Order, and as A.O. Caplis said, Masonic Sorcery Theater with the Force Flies continuing. So what is your forensic analysis and about the consciousness of people understanding that it's not what it seems to be? And I'll listen over the air, and thank you for this program.
Okay, go ahead, George.
Well, first of all, a little bit on methods. Methods that I use are literally all over the board, because not all problems can be looked at the same way. One approach is basic financial modeling, sitting down with a spreadsheet. Another approach is to look at charts of the stock market from the present day and from past periods of American history, and look for similar policies and market performances. Another approach that I use is called the aggregate index approach. That's based on the notion that on any day of the week, there is only so much money in the world. And by noticing the total performance of global markets, one can infer whether money is being made or being lost globally. So that's a real basic look at method. Now, as to 9/11, glad you brought that one up. The reason for that is this. We were in a position where we could have slid into the Greater Depression in the fall of 2001. Now, I wrote extensively about this at the time. The charts were all lining up nicely. The internet collapse took about, depending on which number you use, but $5.8 trillion, or about one-third of an entire year's GDP, off the table in about a 12-month period of time. So when you talk about ritual and consciousness, I don't think there's as much weight should be given to the notion of consciousness so much as should be given to cash flow and people's financial interest. Because you see, what happened with 9/11 is a large enough economic stimulus that it becomes highly suspicious. Economic stimulus in that it gave us an incentive to go to war. Economic stimulus because we hired initially, I think it was 50,000 additional personnel for TSA. There was a huge stimulus in terms of, I hate to call it the terrorism industry, but let's face it, it's an industry. Terrorism has become an institution, and huge profits have been made by consultancies and by contractors, full-body scanner developers. Not saying any of this is bad, but from a forensic economic standpoint, my, it sure is coincidental that when we're about to drop into a Great Depression, along comes a massive economic stimulus, and that was followed by Alan Greenspan's lack of diligence that led to the no-doc loans.
Somebody was sleeping at the wheel then,
But not necessarily. clearly. I mean, you know, the bad news is, yeah, it looks like a suspicious coincidence, but, you know, the good news is the unemployment rate is still not as bad as it would have been. And by having serial bubbles, what's happened since 2000 is we've had this economic gulch out in front of us called the Great Depression, and we're kind of building a bridge of serial bubbles and wars to get across that gulch. The problem is that as we're doing that, the dynamics of the money flows and the world politics are such, the gulch keeps getting bigger. So every time we think we're getting close to the other side with a new war, a new bubble, a new this, a new that, what happens is we actually just push the problem out, kick the can down the road, and when the depression gets here, it ain't going to be a U.S. depression, which the 1930s event was largely U.S. and European. This one's going to be global. It'll take down India, it'll take down China, it'll take down Europe. We'll probably be last to go simply because of dollar hegemony, which so far seems to be hanging on. But beyond that, once we get into this 2017 high risk period, I expect next January, George, we'll be talking about,
we will, and you will be back, George. Up next, psychics that work with law enforcement.